listeners. Welcome to Grief Out Loud. Remember the last time you tried to talk about grief and suddenly everybody left the room? Grief Out Loud is opening up this often avoided conversation because grief is hard enough without having to go through it alone. We bring you a mix of personal stories, tips for supporting children, teens, and yourself, and interviews with professionals in the grief world. Platitude and cliche-free, we promise. Grief Out Loud is hosted by me, Jana DeCristofaro, and produced by the Dougie Center for Grieving Children and Families in Portland, Oregon. No matter what the circumstances are, being placed in the foster care system comes with a lot of grief and loss. Unfortunately, that grief is rarely acknowledged or legitimized. Every change can lead to loss, and children in the foster care system experience so many changes. Who they live with, where they live, who they can have contact with, where they go to school, and what their daily routines are. There's also the uncertainty and loss of autonomy. Children and teens often have no say in what happens in their lives once they are placed in the system. Derek Kirk was one of those children. When he was six, he and his two sisters were taken out of their home and placed in foster care. Derek was eventually placed in an orphanage, which today would be called a group home. While the orphanage provided for his basic needs, food, clothing, a place to live, and the chance to attend school, a lot of his emotional needs went unmet. When he turned 18, Derek aged out of the system and had no place to live until he went to college. Today, Derek is a successful real estate entrepreneur who is dedicated to helping others who are in the foster care system. He does this through his work as a speaker and also as the founder of the Derek Kirk Foundation, which provides direct financial, housing, and other assistance to youth and their families. Derek is also the host of his podcast, My Thoughts with Derek Kirk. Derek had to teach himself a lot. While the system provided for his basic needs, it didn't equip him with the skills and knowledge he needed to live as an independent adult. Now, he's committed to helping other youth get the support he so needed. Just a note, listeners, that in our conversation, we referenced the LIGHT program, which stands for Listening and Led by Youth in Foster Care, Grief, Hope, and Transitions. LIGHT offers peer support groups based on the Dougie Center's model for youth in the foster care system who are experiencing loss. If you want to learn more about LIGHT, be sure to tune into episode 136 and 137. Okay, here's my interview with Derek. Derek, thank you so much for joining me today for Grief Out Loud.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
And your story, and I'm sure we'll talk a little bit more in depth about it, but the basics is that you were orphaned at seven. And a lot of us, when we hear that term orphan, we think of someone who's had both parents die. But how do you relate to that term, that name, an orphan?
I definitely classified myself as an orphan because I lived inside of an orphanage. Due to my parents abandoning me. And so it's still a loss because I didn't have my parents there. And then being placed in an orphanage, that made me an orphan.
And what do you remember about the day that you were placed into the foster care system?
I remember it. I was 6 years old. And it was a regular school day. And when I left home that day, it was pretty normal. Nothing out of the ordinary, what I would consider normal in our household. No red flags anywhere. I went to school that morning. We had breakfast, getting through the day. And I'm sitting in class and my teacher, I guess someone knocks on the door of the classroom. She sees who it is. We can't see who it is. We're on the opposite ends. We're on the same side of the door. She's on the opposite side. So she goes out into the hallway to greet. It was the vice principal and some other people in the hallway. And we hear them talking for some time. So usually if it's something like that, the teacher steps out for just a moment and then she comes back in. But this time it was pretty lengthy. And so in that time, I definitely noticed that, her emotions had shifted and she came back in like something bothered her. She looks directly at me and then calls me to the front of the class. And so I knew by the look in her face, and so did the class, that whatever is she just heard or just learned is very serious. And so she calls me to the front of the class, gives me a long drawn hug, because this was in elementary school, you only have one teacher. And so she gives me a hug because she's the only teacher I've ever known. And so she gives me this long, long, long hug and then says, "I'm going to miss you." And that's not what you kind of want to hear as a six-year-old. Like, you're like, wait, what? And I immediately thought something happened to my mom because of the abuse that was going on inside the home. I thought immediately something happened to my mom. So I turn and look out of the hallway. I see my sisters there. So I immediately think something happened to mom. So I go out in the hallway. She's there. My sisters, I have two sisters. They are standing there. The vice principal is standing there. And there's this mysterious lady with this huge folder in her hand. And I didn't even acknowledge her at all. So I'm looking at my sister and the vice principal, like, what's going on? Like, what happened to mom? And my sisters are thinking the same thing. We don't know what's going on. And so they don't know what's going on. I don't know what's going on. We just started walking down the hallway. As we're being escorted down the hallway, the lady with the huge folder finally lets me know who she is. She say, "Hey, I'm from social services. I'm here to take you guys away from your home because your parents abandoning you. And so we have to find you guys a new home." And so we didn't believe it. We were like, no, our mom would never abandon us. So this is definitely, you're not telling us the whole thing. And because we're kids, we're not going to get the whole thing. And so my older sister, she's kind of the ringleader at when we are younger. And so we kind of do everything she says. We follow her lead. So she grabs our hands and she says, "When we get outside, we're going to run and we're going to run home." And so she's just crying, bawling her eyes out as we walk down the elementary school hallway. And my little sister's doing the same thing. And we get closer and closer to the door. I'm like bracing myself. I haven't shedded a tear yet because I'm still processing. We get outside and we're getting closer and closer to the car. She's just holding our hands tight as if any moment now she's going to just dash and we better keep up. We get closer and closer to the car outside and she gets in the car. She never runs. So we all get in the car and they're crying even harder because it's over. We're in the car. Car's moving, and as the car is driving down the street away from our school, my sisters are just bawling their eyes out because they think we're never going to see our mom again. I'm not shedding one tear. I'm thinking to myself, is something wrong with me that I'm not crying in this situation? So I'm kind of, so many things are running through my head. So many emotions are running through my head. I'm just staring out of the window with curiosity, like, where are we going? And we pull up to this house and she says, "This is going to be your new home." She walks us inside the house. It's a beautiful house in the suburb, nice African-American family that lived there. They were very well to do and they had other kids that was there as well. It was very structured. Coming where I live, we had zero structure. No one really cared what we did every day. We could stay out all night. We didn't have breakfast, lunch, and dinner on a schedule. Some days, most days, we went without eating. These things were normal in my world then. Until I got to this house, that's when I knew, like, oh my God, this is like how families are on TV. Like, we have breakfast on time every morning. A variety of breakfast. We have lunch, we have a snack, and then we have dinner. We have a bedtime, we have TV time. It's pretty structured. We have school, but the school bus picks us up, which was unheard of in our neighborhoods. There's zero school buses. All these things were just so foreign to me, and I had to get adjusted very quickly. And discipline-wise, if you misbehave, the parents would spank you. But that didn't sit well with me. my sisters were good. They never got in trouble, but I did. And one day they tried to spank me. And since I was heavily abused in the previous home, once I got out of that situation, I kind of gave myself a zero tolerance policy on spankings. And so they tried to spank me and it didn't really work out. I pretty much burst and they decided that they could not have me any longer. So they called my social worker back 24 hours later. They removed me from the home away from my sisters that in that same instance. So I was in that home for maybe a month before they realized, okay, we cannot handle this kid. He's too much for us to handle. He is not conforming to how we have things here. So they got rid of me. And at that point, it wasn't anywhere else for me to go. They looked at their system. It was no openings that I would fit. It was only one place for me to go. So they let me know, at this point, Derek, we got to take you to an orphanage. I didn't know what an orphanage was. So they was like, well, it's sort of like a juvenile facility. I'm like, I don't know what that is either.
Because you're seven at this point, right? And they're using words you have definitely not been used to talking about.
I'm almost seven. I'm probably like a month away from being seven. And I don't know what's what, but they're explaining to me what's about to happen in vague details but they're trying their best to talk to pretty much a seven-year-old. We are driving to this facility, and when we pull into this place, these massive gates, they had to be 15-foot gates, 20-foot gates, and it's this university-sized campus that we pull into. And when we pull inside the gates, my breath was just taken away. It had to be about 2,000 kids that live in this facility. It was kids everywhere. Once we pulled in, you know, we're going like 5 miles an hour because there's kids running all across the front of the car, around the car, kids of all ages, from 6 years to 18 years old, kids everywhere. They had everything a kid could want for it in a childhood. They had all the basketball, the hockey. They had everything a kid would want in one place there. They had schools on the campus. They had from elementary school to preschool to high school and middle school, all there. This place was heavily equipped to be its own little city for these kids to grow up in. And it gave me a childhood that I would have never gotten if I kept going foster home to foster home to foster home. It would have been a huge learning curve. This place kind of gave you what you were missing on the outside. With all these kids, it gave you a brotherhood there. It gave you people skills. It gave you skills that you would have struggled to get outside of that place. The schools, if you do well in the schools, they send you off grounds to school. So that way you can actually have a regular experience with a school, like regular kids. And that's what they did for me. And that was a challenge as well. Once I graduated the on ground school, they sent me away to school. And then it's hard not telling people where you live, because you make friends at these middle schools that you go to, and they all want to come stay at your house, or they want you to come stay at their house, and they can't understand why they can't come over your house. They need state approval to come over my house, and I need state approval to come over their house. Their parents have to go through so many background checks for me to stay over their houses. The red tape was just ridiculous. So that never happened. So I never told anyone where I lived. And I just let my friends think it was complicated all through middle school. I never let anyone know. I wanted to keep my home life secret. I wanted to keep that I was an orphan secret as well. I didn't want anyone to feel bad for me. That was one thing I got a taste of that I did not like, is people feeling bad for me. One day in middle school, my teacher found out. I guess she found out from the office my situation. She pulls me to the side once. She said, Derek, I heard your story. It's unfortunate. She says, you don't have to finish the rest of the assignment. And today, just sit there and just be by yourself. And
And you'd been in class. You'd been in class with her for a while, and then she gets the news, and suddenly today you don't have to do the assignment.
I'm a new person to her now, and I didn't like that because I'm sitting there in class and everyone's looking at me like something's wrong with me, and I can't tell them why I'm not doing the why I'm getting good grades and I'm not doing anything in class. I can't explain it. I can't give them the truth. And I didn't like how that felt. I didn't mind doing the assignments. I could do it. It wasn't like I couldn't do the assignments, but she's giving me these freedoms I didn't earn or deserve. And I didn't like it. And so I had the facility call the school so they can kind of stop doing that because you're cheating me out of an education at that point. So none of the other teachers did it. So I got a fair shake with everyone else. And then she ended up stopped doing it. Growing up in an orphanage wasn't as bad as people will perceive it to be. It gave me a childhood that I couldn't have got outside of it because of my circumstances. So that place kind of saved my life in a way.
And Derek, I was thinking as you were talking when you said, you know, in middle school, you kind of just kept it under wraps, right? Because you're mm-hmm. trying to just be in middle school and make friends and go to school, do your assignments, and not wanting to have to really share with people like why they can't come over and play basketball after school at your house. And now you're at a place in your life where you're telling your story a lot through your work on other people's podcast shows, on your podcast show. What is it like in this moment when you go back to that day when you were put in the foster care system? Like, what is it like for you to tell the story now?
What's it like now? I enjoy doing it now because there are now kids the same age I was now that are trying to navigate, or they're becoming an adult and they're trying to navigate. If they only had someone that could give them some advice that navigated those same roads already successfully, there aren't many of us. And so I spent 10 years in that orphanage, and there's plenty of kids that are younger than me that are on that same path and or that are already in college that are making it, but they're having such a hard time and they don't believe that they're gonna make it. So I tell my story now as a guide. So younger people know that there is a way. And so people throughout the country and other countries know that there are people like me that exist in other countries. I get that a lot, that people don't think people live like this in America because of our perception across the country. But I am very real.
I can see you right now. I can vouch that you are real.
Yeah, I am very real. My story is definitely authentic. I definitely want people to know every bit of it. It helps inspire them, even if they've never been in this situation. It helps them inspire them to want more for their lives as well as they see you progress.
So, you know, Grief Out Loud is hosted by the Dougie Center, and we primarily provide peer support groups for kids who have had someone in their life die. But there is a program called Light that was piloted first in South Carolina, and it's mm-hmm. it stands for Listening and Led by Youth, Grief, Hope, and Transition. And Light took the peer support model that we have at the Dougie Center for kids who have had someone die or have someone living with an advanced serious illness and replicated it for youth in the foster care system. And, you know, the youth in those groups, some of them have had someone die, but many of them are grieving the more like the technical term of the non-death losses of being in the mm-hmm. foster care system, of being cut off from their biological family or having to move to different foster care homes or the variety of different non-death losses. And so when you look back on your experience, what are some of the losses that you dealt with?
Yeah. Growing up, you lose in so many ways. Before I went into the entire system, I witnessed the death of my grandmother. So it started there. It was very early in me getting to know her, but she was quickly taken away. I witnessed my aunt quickly taken away as well. And then as I get into the system, you start experiencing loss that are outside of death. You start building these brotherhoods with all of these kids, and then they're getting adopted a month later. And those are really painful for young kids, because kids, friendships when you were a kid are very serious. You can't see the end of a friendship, you know, when you're a kid. You give it your all. So those friendships are real bonds. And every year, you know, countless and countless of brotherhoods are born and then they're taken away. And I have to witness that every single month. We always try not to get adopted in that place because they would bring parents in, kind of like shopping the kids that are out there playing and be like, okay, that kid's nice. Let's go talk to him. And then they'll come over and talk to you. And that's how you get adopted. You have a conversation. They like what they hear. They want to know more. They want to. And then so they go to the office and pull up all your records or dental. And then you get adopted if they like what they see. That's happened to me countless times, but no one actually took me home with them. So I had to be there from 6 all the way to 18, watching kids get adopted, watching parents and families come talk to me. And nothing ever happened for years and years and years. After a certain point, you kind of know it's never going to happen. After you're about 11, you know it's kind of over because you're about 6 feet. You know, at 12 years old, no one's taking you home at that size. So it's kind of over. They usually want the younger kids. When I was 6, I watched a lot of my friends get taken. So those losses and the staff members that come there, they become your parents. They become your big brothers and they look over you and protect you. And then when they go or when they get fired and or when they quit, when they go to a different position in the building and they disappear, those things are painful too. Those moments, all these moments are huge in that world. So you have to look at loss right there. I in middle school, one of our favorite teachers, we watched him pass away as well in school. And so that was tough on us as well. And so these growing up this way, a loss becomes normal. So you become kind of expecting loss. And then when it happens, you're sad, you're hurt, but the recovery is so quick because you're so, you're not numb to it yet, but you're so used to it, that loss, you recover pretty quickly from loss. And I've definitely noticed that over the years that when someone is lost, I do mourn, but it doesn't take long at all before I'm back on my feet. And I credit that to growing up, experiencing so much loss.
Having gone through it so often. And I'm curious, this might be a hard question to answer, but you know, listening to all the different types of losses, including people in your life who have died, and then people just relationships ending, people getting adopted or staff members no longer working there. And looking back, do you have a sense of if you were able to come together and be with other youth who were living there with you and sat down together and had a chance to talk about or process the grief that comes with those losses, what that might have been like for you?
Yes, definitely. That would help, especially with other peers, not just one-on-one. I don't think the one-on-one would have been effective at all because kids would just close down. I would have closed down for sure. But when it's other peers, it's kind of a snowball effect. Someone would share and then another person would share and another person would share. Then it'll kind of get out of hand from there and kids would just open up once they're comfortable that other peers are doing it. So the peer pressure would definitely cause a really great experience. With that, I wish that was there because I could have talked about it a lot. I would have been able to know what to do with these emotions, but we didn't. So we got into fights a lot. We blew up a lot at each other because they kind of expected if something happens and you're hurt, we don't know what to do. All we can do is just outlash and get physical with one another because we didn't talk about it. No one, you know, after someone left and this kid would admit a lot to, you know, our group, no one set us down and say, okay, he's gone. How do you guys feel? Let's talk about next steps, how to get past this hurt. And if they would have done that, it could have been some crying, but it could have been, you know, some rallying to cheer people up to get us back. And they could have turned a negative into a positive, but that wasn't a focus. Maybe because it's so many kids and they go so often that it will be a huge job in itself just to do. And so, yeah, that could have helped definitely.
Yeah. And I think too about how sometimes just acknowledging that it is a loss and acknowledging that grief is part of that loss, like that can go so far, you know, just to like have that space to even just know that for yourself. And I was curious a little bit back in your story of you were put in the foster care system with your sisters and then, you know, taken out of that foster care home. And it sounds like they stayed there. Have you maintained relationships with anyone in your biological family?
Yes. So we all maintain a relationship throughout the entire journey. So we're all really close now. We made sure we kept that closeness, even if we haven't saw each other in months or even a year or so. We made sure we forcefully called or hunt the person. Like, we never actually let each other go. I'll get it. If I'm in the orphanage, they'll call the main office and ask to speak to me. And then they'll route the call to it, so the facility I'm in. And then a staff would come hunt me down. It's a long wait on that phone while they find me. But these are the things that we did to make sure we talk to each other year over year, month over month, week over week, just so we can kind of have that connection if we're on three-way with each other, just to, you know, have an hour conversation about anything. And that's it. Just talking about what you do today, what you do today, what you do today, what you do today. Just it's just so we can hear each other's voices, know we're okay, and still hold on to that bond that we all originally had. So it never went anywhere. So as we got of age, we moved closer to each other and the bond is still there. So it's like we never kind of left each other, but it was on us to kind of hold that together. I'm not sure if others could do that same thing without a system being in place. There was no system in place then. So we had to kind of do it ourselves. And my older sister was the ringleader on that. And so she made sure that that happened.
So she maintained the role that you were describing her in on that day when mm-hmm. you all were taken out of school, and she was like, I'm in charge, here's the plan. Sounds like she maintained that role of like, here's the plan, here's how we're going to stay connected.
Yep.
So looking back, are there certain ways that adults in your life at school or at the home, what did they do that was helpful, or what did they not do that you really needed or would have been supportive?
What they didn't do a lot in that home. It was pretty set in stone what the rules are, what they can and what they can't do. I definitely thought the kids were still cared for. We still had great meals. We had great exercise. We had everything we needed as a kid. Christmas was great. Birthdays were great. I definitely think that on the counseling end, it could have been a lot more. Then the answer for everything was medication. So in an orphanage, your answer is medication. If the kid is too active, medication. If he's too quiet, medication. You know, medication was the number one answer. So not a lot of counseling. It was heavy on the medication. So that's what they did wrong, was they overly medicated us. Every kid in there was on medication. Everyone doesn't need medication, but I guess to make their jobs easier, they medicated, if not 90% of the kids there were heavily medicated, just to be, you know, good kids. And that really didn't work. Some of the medications didn't work for these kids. We were still definitely kids. We were, you know, breaking stuff like kids do. We were noisy like kids do. But a lot of kids, the medications did work for. We would see when they're off their medications and they're moving around and they're noisy. And then when they're on the medications, they just sit quietly. And we're like, okay, that's not normal. That's not him. So even as kids, you know that medications are controlling you in a way. So that's what they did wrong. What they did right was they made sure, you know, we had the environment to be a kid.
The basics were covered. You had your food, your shelter, your activity, but there wasn't a lot of just emotional connection, support, nurturing.
Yeah. And I credit that to the quantity, since it was a lot of us. That's what it was. Since it was so many kids, I think they just felt like if medication would be needed, and when the kids behave a certain way, medications would correct it.
I know that another major transition point for youth when they're in the foster care system is when they age out of it. Mm-hmm. So when you hit, I guess, 18 and you're no longer in the system anymore, what was that transition like for you?
Once you age out of it, that's when things get crazy, because everything is taken care of. And then they kind of take the training wheels off with, you don't have an education on adulthood. So you have to learn adulthood yourself. And many people fall by the wayside. They go to jail or homelessness strikes, or and then, you know, they get addicted to drugs. So after the training wheels off for me, homelessness striked. I was a homeless teen until I went off to college. And that transition part from high school to college, I didn't have a home and I had to sleep in a motel up until that transition. And I definitely didn't know how to be an adult. I didn't know how to manage my money. I didn't take it anything paying bills very seriously because it wasn't taught to me. I had to kind of hold on until school started so I can move into school. And then that's what happened. So it was a rough part, but without university, I would have been homeless a lot longer. And transitioning into a university was definitely tough. I needed a tutor for pretty much almost every class I had, and that was consistent until I graduated. So not much for partying. I definitely had goals for myself that I wanted to achieve, but the road was really, really bumpy. I had to be consistent. I had to fight along the way at every turn without having a lot of tools, especially after being taken out of the orphanage. All the tools are taken away. You kind of got to fend for yourself.
So there was a steep learning curve, not only in the academic side of things, but just in the life side of things, of like,
yep,
how does all this work? No one has shown me how to do this.
I agree. Yeah, that's exactly what it was. It was definitely a messy, messy journey, but now I'm clear. Now it's much better. And I definitely want to be able to give advice whenever I can to help someone else struggling or trying to figure out, what do I do here? I just got released from this place. What's next? How do I navigate? How serious do I need to take this? How serious? These are valid questions that they don't have the answers to, you know? And so I definitely want to be here to help.
So catch us up then on like what's happening now, because a lot's happening now. I mean, you're an entrepreneur, you've got your podcast, My Thoughts with Derek Kirk, you've got your foundation. How's that work happening in the world right now?
The foundation is helping people that grew up like me, whether you're a college student and you're struggling, we help you buy your first car or textbooks for school, or you need some necessities, you need some toilet paper, toothpaste, groceries. And we do the same thing for single mothers as well. And we donate to elementary school classrooms as well, and school supplies. So that's what the foundation definitely does. I also invest in low-income housing, so to provide housing for families like my family, so they have an opportunity to have a stable place to live while they're struggling. And then I have the podcast, and then My Thoughts with Derek Kirk. And so that's kind of what I'm doing now.
And I feel like we create a little gap for our listeners of jumping from college to having a foundation, having a podcast, doing all of this work. Mm-hmm. How did you, is there a short version of how you got from there to where you are now?
Yeah, college, definitely. I studied psychology at Western Michigan University, and I don't do anything in psychology now. I definitely knew I wanted to do business, but I wasn't sure. So, I didn't want to start something and not finish. So I finished psychology, tutors every classroom. It was pretty gruesome struggle to get through college. But after I completed a college, I knew that I wanted to get in business, but I knew nothing about business. So I had to go to school all over again, but I had to be the teacher. And I knew myself, I knew I had the will to relearn, to learn anything new. So I had to, you know, teach myself marketing. I had to teach myself, you know, analyzing the real estate market. You know, I had to do all these things, how to renovate a house, how to flip a house, how to, you know, I had to do a lot and teach myself a lot. But I had the time, you know, after college, I can go live with my sister because now we're adults now. She has a place. So now it's easier to maneuver. And while you're figuring things out, I did that. And I got a job in real estate in the property management sector. And I worked my way up the ladder of in the real estate market until I got into a position that paid me a really good salary. Now I'm able to kind of trampoline off that salary into investments of my own. And so during all that time, I had to educate myself on what I really wanted to do. And so I focused on what was in front of me, which was the job. And they promoted me pretty much to the top of in the corporate office. And I trampolined my income with them over to my own private investments. And now they're pretty successful.
So you got a master's degree in Derek, basically.
Pretty much.
Taught yourself.
Pretty much. You definitely, it's not easy, but you know you. You know, so you know what you're capable of. If someone else doesn't, you just only got to prove it to yourself.
So Derek, I'm sitting here inspired by your commitment to helping other kids and teens who maybe find themselves in a similar situation growing up that you did, and like helping to share all of your hard-won knowledge of like, how do I do this? How do I navigate this? How do I get connected with myself? How do I find my way in this world? And so if there's listeners out there today who either are youth in the foster care system or someone who's supporting them, like what's the best way for them to reach out and connect with you?
www.derekkirk.com is a website, and there's a contact page on there. You can see everything on there from my foundation. We have a blog there as well. And you can catch me on the podcast at My Thoughts with Derek Kirk on any platforms, wherever you're listening to this right now, you can find me there.
Great. Well, Derek, thank you so much for making time today to talk with me at the end of the day, at the end of the week. I know it's a big lift sometimes.
I'm glad to be here. I think I did some good here today.
Well, listeners out there, thank you so much for taking time out of your day to tune into this conversation. If you are new to our podcast, you can find all of our past episodes at our website, dougy.org/griefoutloud, or anywhere that you tune in for your podcasts. And if you want to connect with me, you can send me an email at griefoutloud@dougy.org. Thanks so much for listening, and hope you'll join us again next time.